Good morning. This is Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at WSOU.net. Well, we're so pleased to have back this week with us the very extraordinary Mr. Eugene Pete Wolfe, who is the author of 100 Facts About Boris Johnson. Last week, we were just able to scratch the surface. So we're going to dive a little deeper in this week. Pete, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, so last week, as you pointed out afterwards, you indicated, you know, Darrell, we really didn't talk about the parallels between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, considering the recent news about the FBI, raiding Mar-a-Lago. This is very interesting. But let's talk about the parallels from your perspective.
Okay, so Nick Clegg, who was the Deputy Prime Minister of Britain, once called Boris Johnson Donald Trump with a thesaurus, because there are a lot of parallels. There are also some important differences. One of my favorite Boris stories is right after he first was elected, the election night, he's sitting around waiting for the count, and the photographers are there because he's kind of a celebrity. They take a picture of him with a huge yawn. You're supposed to be excited, not bored. Okay, so they're sort of ribbing him, and he says something like, "You know, when I yawn, I really show my epiglottis." Okay, for those of you who did not go to medical school, right, that's a little flap in the back of your throat that closes your windpipe when you swallow. It's not a word that you use in, you know, casual conversation. In fact, it's not a word that you hear politicians use ever. And I'm just guessing, it is not a word you would hear Donald Trump use in a million years, right? He likes little words, right? So that's a huge difference. Boris Johnson was a classics major at Oxford. He speaks Latin, he speaks Greek, he speaks Italian, he speaks lots of languages. He quotes Latin poetry, Greek poetry. He does all these things that most politicians don't do, right? So here's a guy who's clearly different, right? And he's at the other extreme from Trump, who tries to look, you know, to be down with everybody, small words. Boris Johnson is not mean. He doesn't say nasty things about people. Trump is quite mean. Right. So they're in some ways they're sort of polar opposites. But there are a lot of similarities. For one thing, their attitude toward women or marriage or whatever is quite similar. Both have been married 3 times. Both had the gall. They invited their mistress on a family vacation. Trump went skiing with his family, but also had his mistress come to the same resort. Boris got his wife to allow his girlfriend, who she probably didn't know, or maybe just suspected was his girlfriend, to come on a family vacation. An interesting attitude. So that's one thing. The other thing is they're not politicians. They revel in not being politicians. Boris Johnson became a celebrity by being different, by being eccentric, by being, everybody could tell he was smart, but he also seemed kind of strange, kind of at sea, kind of befuddled. And he actually became a television star by being humiliated on TV, basically. There was a famous situation where he was in the Bullingdon Club at Oxford, which is this sort of fraternity on steroids, and they did all kinds of terrible things. Well, one of the people in the Bullingdon Club was upset about a journalist who wrote a story about him, or maybe said something about his wife. And so he wanted to beat up the journalist. And so Boris Johnson was a journalist. And this guy tried to get Boris to find out the name of the journalist or the address of the journalist, so he could send some thugs to beat him up. And Boris was caught on tape doing this. I mean, it's not a good look. So they played, they had Boris on TV. They played the tapes. he hemmed and hawed, and people loved it. And everybody said, we got to have this guy back. This is amazing. This is, people love this. But Boris is good at being befuddled, right? He's good at looking like he doesn't have a clue, even though he's a really smart guy. That's sort of the opposite of Trump, who wants to be in charge. But Trump, right, I'm in charge, and Trump, okay, is he a good businessman? Well, he started out with a huge fortune that his dad gave him. He's been bankrupt a number of times. Is he a good businessman? I don't think so. Is he good at playing a businessman? Yeah, he's very good at playing a businessman. So, right, so Boris is good at playing like a clueless aristocrat. And Trump is good at playing a businessman who's really successful, even though he really isn't. So they both have these, this have really been really good at cultivating an image. And it was an image that was not sort of the, an obvious thing to be a politician, right? It wasn't, there wasn't an obvious thing. So they both took that image, became very popular, and then got into politics. Okay. So that's, and then once in, you could ask the question, did any of them really, either of them really care about the leader being the leader of their country, right? Getting there, it's an ego trip. It's right. It's fun. Do they have anything they really want to do when they get there? Probably not. Right. So both of them get there. They both are in power for a while and don't do a huge amount. And so they both say lots of things that ain't so. Boris usually more eloquently than Trump. And Boris, just the way he talks generally, he'll say something and you think he said one thing. And then if you look at it carefully, maybe he didn't actually say that. But it turns out it's usually not exactly the way it is. So anyway, they're both of them. They don't really have like a moral compass. They don't have fixed beliefs or fixed ideas of exactly what they want to do. They wanted to become, you know, famous. They did become famous. And so they're quite different in some ways, but they're doing pretty much the same thing. And you mentioned the Trump thing. They both have some trouble with the law. And I would say the final thing, and maybe it's not even the final thing, but Trump lost the election. He's not going to admit it. Boris Johnson has said he's going to resign. They're picking a new conservative leader as we speak. But neither of them are going to go away. Right? So Trump, he might run. He certainly, even if he doesn't run, he's still got a huge amount of support in the Republican Party, which means he's off stage pulling strings. Boris Johnson, yes, he's had to resign, but he's still the most popular politician in Britain. So the conservative,
How do they measure popularity in Britain? I'm curious.
Well, that is a good question. I mean, polls, my understanding is, you know, he still polls really well. I mean, not as well as he did, but the people that are trying to succeed him are not very popular, right? There are two politicians. One is the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, who, I mean, he's a smart guy, but not a huge amount of charisma. The other is the Foreign Secretary. She's trying to be Thatcher, but again, she's not Thatcher. So the head of the Labour Party is a former prosecutor, another smart guy. But again, he's good in a courtroom. He's not really that great in public. But Boris is the only politician who, right, can really get a Trump-like response from lots of people, right? And both of them are, even if they're out, they're not out.
You know, when we look at, you know, the similarities and then the dissimilarities between Boris and former President Trump, the one thing that you see here, like you said, on one hand, Boris, he doesn't mind being embarrassed because I guess when he was the mayor of London coming in with the Olympics,
right?
I guess he came through with a parachute or something like that, where
it was a zip line.
It was a zip line.
Yeah.
Yeah, that ranks up there with former President Bush in the aviator.
Yeah,
outfit, right. For that, is it that Boris just yearns to be at the center of attention?
I think he does, and well, that's not different from Trump, right? But I think Boris, from a young age, has cultivated this personality of, you know, I'm fun. I don't necessarily have any beliefs, but I'm really good at figuring out how to get people engaged, get people to listen to me. He wrote stories. The British call him a lad. Like, he's a guy who sort of does naughty stuff. When he was writing for the Spectator newspaper magazine, he had a column on sports cars, like really expensive sports cars, and he became sort of the story behind the story, in that he had these cars, he'd take them out and he'd write these stories. Usually the stories were about sort of the cars as masculine, ravishing women sort of things. It was all very sexualized. And so that was the story, but behind the story, there were all these antics with Boris and the cars. Boris would get the cars, he'd borrow the cars and so he could write about them. And then he would just sort of park them someplace. They would get towed. He parked one time he parked illegally in front of the Metropolitan Police Department headquarters, and it got towed. Before you get in one of these fancy cars, right, the owners of the cars would have a briefing. Of course, never went to the briefing, right? So he'd send somebody. And one time, the aide that he sent got a phone call. Boris couldn't get out of the car. He couldn't figure out how to use the door because it was a button or something. Anyway, so but this sort of thing feeds the sort of myth or the story of Boris, the guy who's like doing all these things you shouldn't do, and he's such a card. It's so funny. But Boris got married, and he told his wife beforehand, you know, I don't really like this idea of wearing a wedding ring. So he shows up at the wedding place. He forgot his tuxedo. Okay, somebody lets him borrow a tuxedo, gets married. Within an hour, he loses his wedding ring. Loses, right? So, okay, kind of weird. The guy that lent him the tuxedo a couple months later is, I guess, using the tuxedo again or something. And in it, in the pocket, he finds the marriage license of one Boris Johnson. Right? So here's a guy who goes around sort of clueless, and these stories come out and people love it. Here's a guy who it's just a card, and it's not always a good thing. Boris Johnson was the foreign minister for a while. He went on a state trip to Burma, right? And so he's in Shwedagon Pagoda, this beautiful temple, and he's with the British ambassador, and he starts reciting this Kipling poem, Road to Mandalay. So this is a poem written while Burma was a British colony. He's in Burma as the British government representative, about to meet with the government, and he's saying basically, oh, when you were a colony. The ambassador was like, shut up, Boris. But this, right? So these are the kinds of things that Boris does, which people love, but they're not that great. I mean, if you're the British government, you don't really want your foreign minister going out and doing that kind of stuff.
putting his foot in his mouth. Yes.
But he does it in a way that makes people think this guy is so fun.
He wants to be fun. And so let's talk about the comparison of Boris Johnson with a Gorbachev, the clerk in Ozawa. I mean, you know, it seems to me like the names that I just mentioned are up here, but then, but what are those comparisons?
So Gorbachev, de Klerk, and Ozawa
And actually, as it relates to the tactics for political reform.
Yeah. So all of those three were party stalwarts. They were people who came through the party, and to a considerable extent, people in the party didn't think they would ever turn against the party, right? So Gorbachev came to power after three really decrepit leaders. In fact, Leonid Brezhnev, I think, technically died in 1976 on a plane. His personal physician revived him and then soon after became Minister of Health. But Brezhnev survived until 1981, but he was really out of it. Then there was Yuri Andropov, Konstantin Chernenko, these old guys. So Gorbachev said, look, all we need is a strong, you know, youthful leader. The system will be fine. People believe that. He's a party guy. So people in the party thought, here's a guy who will make the party work better, right? And what he did was basically say, okay, we want the party to work better. And what we'll do is party leaders need to run for election. We'll have elections to this body that doesn't usually in the past answer to the party. We'll have these elections. Party people should run for them. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's, so basically forcing people to be party people to be popular. But they didn't. He said, we want you to win, right? We want the party to stay in control. So people believe that. And when the elections started getting out of control and the party started losing power, right, it was a little too late. But again, here was a party guy. De Klerk, again, had been in the National Party, right, his whole life, very conservative. The people who voted for de Klerk voted for a guy they thought would prevent reform, not carry it out. And he said, okay, you know, basically us whites, we're smarter than the blacks, and I will out-negotiate him. We can have Mandela come out of prison. They're blacks, right? We'll out-negotiate him, and we'll figure out some way so we can maintain power and we can get people to stop bugging us. Didn't actually work out that way. But people trusted him because here was a guy who all his life, all his career had shown, I will do what's good for the party. Ozawa, somewhat similar situation, had been in the Liberal Democratic Party his whole life, was really, really good at fundraising. And the problem with the Japanese political system was, or one of them, is they have an electoral system where 3 to 5 people were chosen from each district. And what that meant was there's one party, the Liberal Democratic Party, that's been in power since it was created in 1955. So in most districts, what happened was members of the LDP ran against each other. Well, if you're running against somebody in your own party, you can't really say, I'm different from Fred because I'm pursuing a different policy. So what you have to do is raise money. So what this system fostered was a huge amount of political corruption. So for the problem with that for politicians was older politicians who had an established network, they were fine because people voted for them because they've always voted for them. They've done a lot for the constituents. The problem was with younger politicians. Mm. Younger politicians come in, and then if people are mad at the LDP, those are the ones who lose. So Ozawa said, when there was a big scandal in 1993, Ozawa said, look, I'm really good at raising money. If you join me in leaving the LDP, I'll make sure you get reelected. And once we get out of the LDP, we can force a change in the election system, which will get rid of this corruption. And then we'll have a better system. Everybody will love it. Okay, so that's what he did. People got out of the, they changed the election system. In the long term, everybody sort of migrated back to the LDP, but that's another story. But so all these guys had a huge amount of loyalty to the party, a huge amount of support in the party. They were party people. And that's how they got the party to come along with them. Okay, that's them. Boris, Trump, not that way at all, right? So they have power outside the party. Boris gets becomes a personality. Trump becomes the apprentice, the head of the apprentice, right? They have these things. And politicians from their party generally do not like them. What do they believe? Who knows, right? They're nasty in terms of Trump. They, right? It's not clear what they want to do. They're not incredibly competent. But in both cases, right, they sort of force themselves on the party.
You know, Trump, it's very interesting is that they have this very vocal minority that is a solid block, if you will, that follows them no matter what happens. They seem to follow them. You know, as they say, they see that they do no wrong, you know, for that.
That is a mystery
about our society.
Excuse me?
What does that say about our society?
Oh, I don't think it says anything good. I mean, I would say it's probably a bit different in both places, right? I mean, in the U.S., I think there's been a long history of sort of anti-intellectualism, right? We used to have a know-nothing party. Maybe we do have a know-nothing party, right? There's a sense of the elites, you know, we're against the elites for whatever reason. And it's sort of amazing that you get all these Ivy League educated people who can claim that they are against the elites. And a billionaire, supposed billionaire, who claims he could be against the elites. I mean, look in the mirror, dude, right? So, but there is a sense of, I think, for a lot of people, there is a sense that the country is not working for in the way that it used to. Mm-hmm. And they're pissed. Mm-hmm. And so somebody who reflects their pissed offness, right, is, and that's what Trump did. He said things that, you know, regular politicians wouldn't say, and right. Usually nasty things. And people said, "Hey, he's playing our tune." Boris
wonder, and when I get into conversations with folks, because normally in my business I don't talk politics, but
yeah.
But when I'm having a conversation with someone, I'll ask them, "Why are you so angry?" You know, and when you really peel back the onion is they really don't understand why they are angry when, you know, they have great opportunities here in the United States.
Well, so my view, if you look at right after World War II, right, think of Europe was destroyed, Japan was destroyed, right? The only place with that wasn't destroyed was the U.S. Well, not the only place, but I mean, right? So in the 20, 30 years after World War II, this was fantastic. You could go out of high school, get a good factory job, have a, you know, nice life, own a house, car, a boat, vacation house, take nice, right? It was a good situation, right? Now, the middle class is in battle, right? Mm-hmm. Factory jobs don't really exist. You know, they're not nearly as many of them. Service jobs don't pay as much. Lots of jobs require college education, even if they don't really. So there are lots of people who feel like, you know, the American dream is not really in reach. And I mean, the reasons for that are, right, the global economy has changed. China and India, which, you know, 30 or 40 years ago had a stupid economic policy, communism, or at least lots of rules and regulations. Now they're saying, hey, we're going to try to actually do things a non-stupid way, right? So there are all these, the world has changed, the economy has changed, and it's not really clear what you can do about that. But what populists do, what somebody like Trump does, says, well, we can blame people. the reason things are bad for you is because all these people are coming from across the border, or because we're giving women rights, or because we're having affirmative action, or right, all these, blame all these people.
Right.
And
right.
that's because we don't really have a solution. But hey, nasty, right? I mean, people are pissed. And so saying, you know, right, Hitler, right? Blame the Jews.
Yeah.
Instead of having a, instead of solving the problem, at least you just make people think, yes, well, you know, it's that their fault.
Yep.
So that's, you know, what he does.
For our last few minutes, I did want to touch upon it. I'm going to have you back because you give so much great detail. Let's talk about what your current research is on in regards to the legislative violence in the Europe, U.S., and Japan. What do you think is the crux of this legislative violence? First of all, define legislative violence for our audience, and then let's talk about that.
Yeah, I'm interested in fights in parliament, in legislatures. We've had them in the U.S. We don't have as many of them as we used to. But I was they seem to be a central feature of any legislature, right? People get annoyed, people get upset. But nobody really has looked at why this happens or whether it matters. So I found just some interesting examples. So in Mexico, right after the Mexican Revolution, so in the 1920s and 30s, there were at least 6 or 7 shootouts in the Mexican legislature.
Mm.
Shootouts.
Wow.
People died, right? In Yugoslavia, right after World War One, there was growing tension between different ethnic groups, and a Serbian politician took a gun out in parliament and shot 4 Croatian deputies.
Wow.
So sometimes it gets really bad. And nobody's really looked at this. And I think it's fascinating. Japan, which is where I know a little bit about, there have been cases where the government has called 500 policemen to come to the Diet to restore order. That's pretty interesting. So my question or my research is about, why does this happen? I think there are a variety of reasons, but one of the things that I'm arguing is that violence is sometimes the continuation of politics by other means. So it's sometimes in the U.S., the interesting thing in the U.S., it's almost always personal. Somebody calls somebody else a liar, generally, and they try to fight. Almost always, that's the only thing. In other countries, every other country, you get brawls in which lots of politicians fight each other. In the U.S., it's just mano a mano, right? So I think that's one of the reasons why people don't really pay as much attention, because most people who study legislatures focus on Congress.
Right, right.
So for Congress, right, the idea that people could try to physically prevent the majority from doing something is just absurd, because it doesn't happen here. But in Japan, it does.
Wow. Considering the recent shooting of the former prime minister, the killing of the former prime minister of Japan. This is a very, very, very serious topic. When do you think you will have this research completed and your book published?
I give up. When is the, I don't know. I don't know about that, right? But I'm working on it. At the moment, I'm trying to get a list of all the incidents I can find. I've got probably over 1,000 incidents everywhere. I've got 100 incidents in Japan. I've got 50 or so in the U.S. Italy has over 100. France has over 200. So I've been collecting stuff.
Wow.
And I got to figure out what it all means. So it's taking a while.
Well, Pete, believe it or not, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for coming on the program, and we got to have you back. And ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Mr. Eugene Pete Wolf, who is the author of Boris Johnson in 100 Facts. And we're looking forward to his next book, which is going to talk about legislative violence around the world in politics. Pete, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that wraps it up for this week on Leadership with Darrell W. Gunter on Seton Hall University's WSOU 89.5 FM. Have a great weekend, but remember, leadership begins with you.